This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole.
And I'm Ashley Jeffcoat. New development is something that gets talked about a lot these days. That's probably because there's a lot of it going on.
Oh, yes.
Colorado still has a reasonable amount of land available for building, but water is another story. And it's getting more expensive for developers to get it in northern Colorado.
As a builder, you know, we have to pass it on, you know, to the consumer. As the cost of water goes up, the cost of a house goes up.
We'll look at how the price of water is sending ripples throughout the housing market.
School is out for summer, but Colorado education officials, yeah, they still have some homework to do, figuring out how to curb a growing teacher shortage. We'll hear how that's playing out in some rural schools.
And later, we visit a Greeley design shop that, for more than a century, has been working with some very big heads of state.
So we got to do things like the president of Guatemala, the president of Mexico, secretary general of the United Nations. And this one was cool at the time, but politics changed as we actually did a hat for Vladimir Putin. I think he wears it when he wrestles his tiger.
Plus, we will hear from the always neighborly Howie Mofsovitz about the new Mr. Rogers documentary.
But first, more Colorado voters participated in the June 26th primary election than ever before. Unaffiliated voters were mailed ballots for the first time, and both political parties had contested races. But the governor's race will come down to two very different candidates. KUNC's State House reporter Benta Berklin has more.
Republicans are hoping State Treasurer Walker Stapleton will put the governor's office in GOP control for the first time in a dozen years. Democrats think Congressman Jared Polis is the right choice to replace Governor John Hickenlooper, who is term limited.
Now both candidates have a challenge to talk about issues that they did not talk about in the primary election.
Dick Wadhams is the former GOP state party chairman. He says both Polis and Stapleton went to their respective ideological corners to win in the primary.
Jared Polis clearly is the most liberal Democratic nominee for governor we've ever seen. Walker Stapleton embraced Donald Trump to win the Republican nomination.
For example, Stapleton ran as a supporter for President Donald Trump's tax cuts and immigration policies.
The president has offered the ability for a million people plus to have legal status in this country, many of them dreamers, many of them children, in exchange for enhanced border security. And we can have both. We do not have to choose one or the other.
It's a message that resonates with Mesa County Commissioner Rose Puglisi. She says she's gotten to know Stapleton over the years because he's reached out to rural Coloradans in his role as state treasurer. She also thinks Trump's popularity, especially in rural parts of Colorado, will help Stapleton.
President Trump's policies have been really good for my county. A lot of people can see if you really were to talk about his policies, it's hard to point to one that really hasn't been good for our country or for rural America.
Meanwhile, Jared Polis pitched himself as someone who can work with the president if it's good for Colorado.
And if President Trump is serious about investing in infrastructure, if he's serious about creating jobs, he'll have a partner in me. But you know that I won't be beholden to him. And when he divides us rather than unites us, I will stand up with an inclusive Colorado voice.
A pathway to citizenship for immigrants who grew up in the U.S. but weren't born here is a top priority for Norberto Morhardin. He's a small business owner from Denver and thinks Polis would support the Latino community.
For me, that's our future of Colorado. And by him winning in the elections, he can make a big difference for our dreamers more than anything.
If elected, Polis could also become Colorado's first openly gay governor. It's expected to be a divisive governor's race. Right after the votes were counted, the candidates started distinguishing themselves leading into the general election. Here's Stapleton and then Polis.
Jared Polis has spent an unprecedented amount of money to buy this election. He has spent more money to win a contested race on the Democratic side than the Republicans, Democrats, and all outside groups spent combined in the last election. So it is David versus Goliath. I am ready to be David.
On almost every question before us this election, from whether or not healthcare is a human right, to whether immigrant children deserve human decency and human rights, to even the basic question about whether or not honesty is important in the public sphere, Walker Stapleton comes out on the wrong side.
This race and other ballot issues are likely to draw out more voters this November, including unaffiliated voters. Secretary of State Wayne Williams says the primary could be an indication of that. More than 1 million people participated, the highest number the state's ever had.
So the fact that both parties had interesting races, both parties had important races to decide, drove that turnout.
Democrats participated at higher rates in the primary compared to Republicans, and more unaffiliated voters chose to vote in the Democratic primary. How this translates to the general election is unclear. It could be a sign of enthusiasm for Democrats, or it could be because of other factors. Polis spent more than $10 million of his own money to try to get out the vote. I'm Benta Berkland at the State Capitol.
Nuclear testing during the Cold War sent radioactive fallout far away from the test sites. In a Senate hearing this week, politicians moved to expand who can be compensated by the government for getting sick after exposure to that fallout. KUNC's Ray Ellen Bichelle has more.
The tests mostly happened in Nevada, but winds sent radioactive materials far and wide. Idaho Senator Mike Crapo said one test in 1952 was especially memorable to his constituents.
Idahoans that I've spoken to in Emmett and elsewhere have shared their memories of waking to find their pastures and orchards covered with a fine gray-white dust that seemingly appeared out of nowhere. It looked like frost, yet it was not cold to touch.
Crapo is one of the senators sponsoring a bill to amend the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act of 1990. Right now, it only compensates people who lived in Nevada, Utah, and Arizona at the time. The change would add people who lived in places like Idaho, Colorado, and Montana. It would also establish a grant program for further research into the health impacts of uranium mining. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ray Ellen Bichelle. As more people move into the West, interactions between humans and bears have increased. Now, Yellowstone National Park is asking visitors to help save bears in a weird way. By honking at them.
Honking at them?
Honking at them.
What?
It's a little weird, but it would also make for some excellent bumper stickers.
Yeah.
Experts say people in the nation's oldest national park aren't treating bears like the wild and potentially dangerous animals they can be. In fact, some visitors are feeding bears from their cars.
A fed bear is basically a dead bear.
Now, that's Yellowstone spokesperson Morgan Worthen. She says they've had several instances just recently of people giving food to bears. Not a good idea to get close to any wildlife, even if you feel like you're safe in your vehicle.
Worthen is calling on visitors to scare those hungry bears away by honking at them and then driving off.
It's a deterrent. So if you honk your horn, then the bear reacts to that and will likely move away from the vehicle. And it teaches the bear that they're not going to get anything.
Now, places like Yellowstone and Rocky Mountain National Park are usually quite busy over the summer. So it's pretty important to find ways to help ensure the safety of all those millions of visitors and to keep the bears safe, too.
We do love the bears.
We do.
Duh, bears. Summer is full of great things. Summer vacation, exploring Garden of the Gods or a national park, hanging out at the pool, fireworks for the 4th.
Yeah, not to rain on your 4th of July parade here, Ashley, but there is a downside.
Let me see. The intense heat, the sunburn. how about the dive bombing barn swallows on my porch right now?
Oh, great. Yes, there is all of that. What I'm talking about, though, is orange barrel season. Drivers in northern Colorado will get a taste of that very soon. Crews are set to start working along a 14-mile stretch of I-25 in northern Colorado in July. It's a huge project, $330 million, and it will add a third tolled lane in each direction from Fort Collins to just past the Johnstown exit. Johnny Olson is a regional director for the Colorado Department of Transportation.
Over the next 3 years, I'm going to ask for everybody's patience. Every construction project will have impact. And there will always be a little bit of pain points over the construction phasing.
Now, CDOT is required by state law to keep a minimum of 2 lanes open during the day, but that doesn't apply at night. So, yeah, go ahead and expect periodic nighttime closures.
Be prepared. Mm-hmm. Another side effect of the quickly growing Front Range, home prices continue to climb. In June, the average price in Fort Collins hit $420,000.
Whoa.
Supply versus demand is one factor behind the uptick, but as KUNC's Matt Bloom reports, there's also another factor driving up the cost, water.
As northern Colorado's population grows, along with the need for homes, buyers are paying more than they ever have for water rights, especially for new homes.
Hello.
Nancy and Stephen Innes just moved into their new Tuscan-style residence in Greeley. It's packed with lots of water-saving features, like this faucet that turns on with just a wave of your hand.
So water conservation is even here in the kitchen.
But they had to pay an additional $38,000 just to get the water flowing in their home. That's pretty normal for new properties in Greeley, according to a 2015 city survey, and it's something they budgeted for.
It was a huge factor because I know I watched the movie The Big Short, and at the very end, they asked Christian Bale, okay, what's your next big venture? What did he say? Do you remember?
The water, right?
Water.
And residents aren't the only ones feeling the pinch.
This is where I meet with customers and talk about building their dreams.
Jay Jensen is the man behind the Innes' dream home. He's an old-school builder who still draws his blueprints by hand. He says many of his customers have no idea how big a factor water is in the cost of a new home.
They all think, oh, we'll spend $200,000 on a house. Well, you're more than likely going to spend $40,000 to $60,000 before you even start building.
He says it's become a new barrier to ownership for some people, and that he's seen some clients walk away from a project.
As a builder, we have to pass it on, to the consumer. As the cost of water goes up, the cost of a house goes up. That's bottom line.
I spoke with several developers, both large and small, and they all said the same thing. Northern Colorado residents are paying more because cities and counties are squeezed for water rights. Bob Sutton is a longtime realtor in Fort Collins.
So Fort Collins continues to grow. We have the same amount of water to work with that we've had for many, many years. And so it's just a simple supply and demand.
And it's not just new homes that are being affected.
If you have a house on one side of the street that was built 10 years ago, and their water tap was $17,000 or $18,000, and you'd go to build a new one across the street, and now it's $32,000, you effectively raise the older home by the same amount of money because the value of the water tap changes as the market rate changes.
Cities and towns know how difficult it is to compete for water rights, and they don't want it to scare off potential developers. Windsor has recently changed its policy to give them a break.
We will allow you to pay up to 50% of your raw water requirements in the form of cash.
Dennis Wagner is the head of engineering for the town's public works department. He says it's proven to be a very popular option.
So a lot of developers are doing that because, first of all, it's getting harder and harder to find water rights. And so anytime they can pay cash instead of going out and trying to find it on their own, they will do that.
Many communities, like Greeley, are considering or already have similar policies in place. That doesn't necessarily make things less expensive for residents and builders like Jay Jensen, but it does make it easier to build.
Okay. Good boy.
Jensen brings his golden retriever, Wally, with him to every project site. Today, he's in a neighborhood on the east side of Greeley. He points to the water meter pit in the front yard.
So the water now comes up to this pit, but we don't have a meter in it yet. That when we do set it, it will go through the meter and into the house.
The cost of tapping into this one in particular, $36,000. Jensen says back when his company first started building homes in 1984, the average price was just $7,000.
More people using a finite resource.
Yeah, more people wanting the same thing.
For KUNC, I'm Matt Bloom in Greeley.
Okay, don't go anywhere. We have lots more coming up in this episode, like a visit to a shop in Greeley that's been dressing the heads of state for over 100 years. Before we get to that, though, some homework.
No, not fair. It's summertime. Don't give me homework.
Oh, come on. It's actually not for us. It's
actually work
for state lawmakers and education officials. They have a really hard to solve problem on their hands, how to get more teachers into Colorado classrooms. The state is experiencing a growing teacher shortage, and that's hitting rural schools especially hard.
KUNC's Stephanie Daniel spent time at some schools in northeastern Colorado to see what they're doing to get by.
About 5,000 teaching positions go unfilled each year in Colorado, and pay is often cited as a factor. The state ranked 46th in the nation for average salary in 2016, and it's hard for rural districts to keep up.
If you lose a teacher, there's nobody that you can just snag from the community to come in.
That's Democratic Representative Barbara McLaughlin, who was also a former educator. During this year's legislative session, she said the state needs to do more.
It's hard to work in a business that the pay is low, the respect is low, the work level is really high, and there's no time to take a break.
But it would be up to voters to approve any tax increase that could lead to a sizable bump in pay. So some rural schools have found technology to be a cheaper way to bring more teachers to their students. My reporting on this issue took me to Julesburg Junior Senior High School in April. That's where I met Senior Beau Blockwitz. He was in the library talking with one of his teachers.
Hey, Mrs. Brophy.
Did you look in Schoology at the assignments that you have to complete? So you have due dates listed, the different assignments.
In many ways, this is a typical conversation, but Blockwitz is using his laptop. And Brophy.
My teacher is over in Haxton, Colorado. If I have questions, I can say, hey, Mrs. Brophy, and she'll come over and I can see her and we can talk face to face and I can share my screen and stuff. So if I'm working on an assignment and I need help, I just push that button and it'll show my computer screen to her. And it's pretty neat.
Brophy teaches online business classes for students all over the Northeastern Plains. Blockwitz has taken several of them already, but as a senior, it doesn't fit into his schedule. So he's sitting in on another class while working independently.
About 10 years ago, as a small rural district, we were concerned about having limited resources and learning options for our kids compared to kids in the Front Range or anywhere else that's an urban or metro area.
Sean Unis is the superintendent and principal of the Julesburg School, which has about 300 students. With a small number of teachers, they've turned to online classes to fill in the gaps.
So now we can offer our students about 130 classes from an online curriculum ranging from anthropology to Mandarin Chinese to all kinds of core curriculum classes as well.
Online learning is not new. There are numerous organizations offering classes all around Colorado. That's why it's hard to quantify the number of schools and students that utilize these courses. But the state does track one vendor.
Hey, best buddy.
About 10 minutes down the road from Julesburg is the town of Ovid and the Revere School. Brandon Marquez is the principal.
Our schedule's really, really tight because I have one teacher for every content area. And so when we have that class, we have it one time a day.
All 130 students, K through 12, are housed in a single building. Revere uses a few companies to provide online classes, including Colorado Digital Learning Solutions, or CDLS.
We can't offer the extracurriculars or the maybe we need to be on a different track with a kid. And that allows us to do that with that online. They have their own teacher. We just have to oversee it.
CDLS offers hundreds of classes, which the state partially funds. Almost half of school districts had at least one student enrolled in one of those classes this past year. And of those, nearly 90% were from rural districts like Revere.
Really, online has become a huge resource.
Michelle Murphy is the executive director of the Colorado Rural Schools Alliance. In addition to classes, students can also attend a full-time online school. But she's critical of those who think this is the answer to the teacher shortage.
We're wary of folks who think that sometimes perhaps we should replace some of our small rural schools with complete online platforms. And of course, we're wary of that conversation because we see the critical importance of the student-teacher and school relationship and then the school environment.
Back in the Julesburg School Library.
I like it because I can expedite my learning process compared to like a traditional school.
Senior Beau Blockwitz says the flexibility of online classes has allowed him to pursue his dream job, to fly commercial airplanes.
I probably truly wouldn't be able to be where I'm at now, and I wouldn't be able to have partially taken my private pilot's license, and I for sure probably wouldn't even be as skilled enough to probably go be a pilot.
While distance learning works well in rural schools, the principals I spoke to still want to have their own teachers in their classrooms. As I found out, some districts are going far outside the box to fill open positions. More on that in our next story.
That was Stephanie Daniel. You'll find the other stories in this series at KUNC.org. Rodeo season is in full swing. Whether you're heading to the Greeley Stampede or to Cheyenne Frontier Days, you're bound to see Trent Johnson's works in both the ring and in the stands. If you don't know who that is, KUNC Arts and Culture reporter Stacey Nick explains.
Since 1909, Greeley Hat Works, or The Shining Parlor as it was known back then, has been making hats.
I'm the fourth hat maker to own it, and I've been doing this about 25 years.
That's owner Trent Johnson.
Is there a phrase for hat maker? Is it a name?
It's a hatter. Some people think haberdasher, but that's somebody that ran like a men's store that sold hats and clothes and shoes. And a milliner, which is a completely different process, really specializes in ladies' hats.
Greeley Hat Works is known for its custom hats, which are mostly made of European hair, that's H-A-R-E, and beaver fur.
There's different grades of beaver fur, like there's different grades of leather, so we really only use the fine underhair off the beaver's belly.
A custom hat is molded to your exact head shape and size. Now, that sounds like it would require a very high-tech process, right?
We use what's called a conformateur. It was invented in 1843. Ours is built about 1900.
The mechanical top hat features more than 40 wooden pegs and pins. And while it looks like some kind of Victorian torture device, the process itself is completely painless.
We'll take the conformateur and we'll put a piece of cardstock in it. And as we put it on your head, and then as you push it down, it moves all those pins around and gives me a picture, the shape of your head.
Back here is where we do the blocking, flanging, and sanding of hats.
On a tour of the shop, General Manager Damon Smith tells me that most of the equipment used here was built between the early 1900s to about 1953. Everything from the Singer sewing machine to the Italian finger blocker.
It's called a Michelangeli hat blocking device. We bought that maybe 10 years ago and rebuilt it. It was in pretty rough shape when we first got it, so we tore it all down and refit all the parts and painted it and put it back together.
15 years ago, Smith was just a Greeley Hat Works customer. He struck up a friendship with Johnson, who later asked if he was looking for work. Smith says he jumped at the chance to give hat making a try. He started as a hat builder, blocking and sanding hats, and moved up from there.
Anytime someone gets really good at their job, we'll just sort of add a new job on there, and there's infinity jobs.
Make it look like that. Almost like tying your shoes, almost like the stitching of a baseball.
Deja Morales has only been with Greeley Hat Works since November. He's still working on mastering sewing sweatbands and doing trim work. He never expected to work in hats, but says he's discovered a new passion for fashion.
There is so much more about hats than just a hat. It's like food. Like when you cook food, you put soul into it. It's more than just, you know, food. It's a part of you. You know, it's an art. It's the same thing with hats.
Owner Trent Johnson says the majority of people who buy Greeley Hat Works hats are everyday folks, often with an agricultural background.
That's our bread and butter. That's really what keeps everybody here fed. However, we get to do lots of fun stuff.
That fun stuff includes making hats for everyone from bronc riders and rodeo queens to celebrities like country artist Drake White and members of the rock band Aerosmith. They even made all of the hats for Kevin Costner's new TV series, Yellowstone.
Ranching is the only business where the goal is to break even.
Johnson also made hats for Presidents George H.W. and George W. Bush. A contract with the State Department meant he was the hatter making gifts Bush 43 would send to dignitaries around the world.
The President of Guatemala, the President of Mexico, Secretary General of the United Nations, and this one was cool at the time, but politics changed as we actually did a hat for Vladimir Putin. I think he wears it when he wrestles his tiger.
In the showroom, a giant card catalog sits in the corner.
In each drawer alphabetizes everybody's head pattern that we've ever done. Because we have a lot of repeat customers as well, so it's important to keep all that kind of stuff on file.
But don't expect there to be some hidden second card catalog, you know, for the celebrities.
We keep the celebrities in with the hardworking people. They're all the same. They're all the same when it comes to building the hat.
I don't care about that. For KUNC, I'm Stacey Nick.
My girl, but don't touch mine. No, it never comes plain. It never cries. It looks so.
Now to the movies and a film about a very famous television show. Now, most of us know Mr. Rogers because of the wonderful neighborhood he created for children. KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, says the new movie, Won't You Be My Neighbor, shows that Rogers was up to much more than just that TV show.
Towards the end of Won't You Be My Neighbor, director Morgan Neville includes a few TV broadcasts by people who think Mr. Rogers was destroying America. And they're the picture of everything Fred Rogers resisted. They're noisy, accusing, their faces are contorted with anger. Fred Rogers, on the other hand, was soft-spoken, gentle, respectful, and truthful. He did not threaten the existence of the Republic, unless the Republic needs even more anger than it's got, and unless kindness is what will ruin us. I was too old for the TV show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood when it started in 1968. The first inkling I got of how the show touched children was watching a 3-year-old friend sit quietly in front of the TV and softly respond when Mr. Rogers greeted the kids or asked a question. The show didn't wind her up or set her to hyperactive pacing. For that half hour, she was calm and relaxed. Rogers died in 2003, but the film includes clips from the many interviews he did during his lifetime. As Rogers says in one of them, you don't need to wear a funny hat to have a relationship with children. And kids were taken by his unassuming ways. Even through the TV screen, kids seemed to trust him. Rogers appreciated silence. On the show and off, he pauses before he speaks, and then his words come slowly and quietly. He was a thoughtful man who actually seemed to think before he opened his mouth. Silence was not dead air for Mr. Rogers. Silence was articulate. Silence gave his young viewers, and also the adults in the audience, time and space to absorb and understand tough subjects, because Rogers did not avoid the tumult and crises of the world outside the show. When a fight over integrating public swimming pools became news, Rogers sits with his bare feet in a small tub. Officer Clemens, the show's African-American policeman character, enters and tells Mr. Rogers that his feet hurt after a long day. So Mr. Rogers invites Officer Clemens to take off his shoes and join the foot bath. And you get a shot of two pairs of feet, one black, one white, together enjoying the tiny pool. Rogers understood metaphor. He introduced the assassination of Robert Kennedy with a balloon suddenly losing its air, and then show regular Judy Rubin talks to the tiger puppet about what the word assassination means. Early in the movie, Rogers at a piano describes helping children through what he called difficult modulations, meaning changes in life. And he does this by showing the easy musical shift from C to F and the harder one from F to F sharp. Director Morgan Neville understands Fred Rogers pretty well. Like Rogers, the film Won't You Be My Neighbor moves slowly and gracefully. The movie doesn't rush, it doesn't push, it gently unfolds a portrait of a remarkable man. The documentary respects Fred Rogers, and it respects the audience well enough to give us the room to take in what this man did and stood for in his life. The film lets the audience grasp the notion that simplicity can be rich and complicated. Rogers was driven by his belief that children and other people deserve respect. To do that, his show created a deceptively simple environment. Mr. Rogers comes in the door and right away changes from a suit jacket into one of his famous cardigan sweaters. He takes his audience into a protected world where viewers might breathe easy and then be able to absorb sometimes difficult things. Won't You Be My Neighbor copies the spirit of the TV show. You can see through fresh eyes, and if you didn't already know it, you can see that to a world full of rude hostility, Fred Rogers offered the opposite. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mofshevitz.
We are happy to be your neighbors with Colorado Edition. Carly Huckles produced our show this week, along with me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Ashley Jeffcoat. Managing editor Brian Larson contributed to our show. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana.
Other music we heard in this episode, Poddington Bear with Wavy Glass, Mandelbrot's In Winter from Forest Robots, Backed Vibes by Kevin MacLeod, and Spinning Ratio with Long Way Home.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. If you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more great stories for you.
And you can subscribe to Colorado Edition so you don't miss an episode. Do that at KUNC.org or wherever you like to get your podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.